people are able to go to clinics and do this. And then there's an underground movement of often trained therapists and psychologists who are using this medicine in a therapeutic way with people and in an ethical therapeutic way, not just I'm taking Molly and rolling at a club. And that's what this conversation is, right? Is a therapeutic context. Before we start this episode, I have a celebration to share, and this is from one of our clients who, among other things, is working on healthy boundaries. Healthy boundaries has been a big theme in our community lately, and I wanted to say that, you know, I think that one of the things that we often find is that healthy boundaries are a work in progress. They're something that we continue to evolve and grow in as we age. And for me, I think that sex and dating and relationship wins are huge, and we have those, and I'm proud of those, and I'm excited about those. And I'm equally as excited about wins like this, because this kind of boundary setting, healthy boundary setting, is really at the foundation of a man or just a human being being in their power, right? Being able to assert themselves in a healthy way and maintain their own sense of self and self-care and self-love, because boundaries are a form of self-love. So I guess I just wanted to say in advance that while this might seem a little bit like a departure from the episode you're about to hear, I actually think that healthy boundaries are deeply related to connection and love, really, love. So here is a celebration from one of our clients. Imagine you're a full-on 40-something, accomplished professional adult. You've had a good and supported life, but have also lived through some very real struggles, and you've survived various forms of hardship, and you've grown to be resilient and tenacious. You're having a pretty normal everyday experience, and then suddenly you're triggered and you may as well be 10 years old again. A few days ago, I was in my bedroom with a sales rep who was giving me an estimate to replace my leaking window. I'm essentially standing in the corner and he's standing between me and the exit. Space and our position within it matters. He is obnoxiously pushing for the sale right on the spot. 15K. Full court press, won't take no for an answer. Rewind to 10 years old. I started to experience this with guys. Emphasis on the plural, because it was always more than one guy inflicting the pain. Being physically backed into a corner and then slammed into the wall, locker, or door, accompanied by verbal assault. I'm not exaggerating when I say some variation on this theme happened thousands of times over the course of the next 8+ years. I've never done that math before this writing, and those numbers sound crazy, but it happened. It was never a matter of if something was coming, but when and what form it would take. I was perpetually on guard. Sad to say, I still am. Fast forward back to the sales rep. He's putting the pressure on. Him. What's preventing you from doing business today? Me. I have some things to sort out. Him. Like what? Me. I have to talk to my insurance company. Him. When? What do you have to talk about? It goes on a while longer, but you get the picture. I kept placing ownership of the decision outside of myself, which only invited him to push more. At this point, I'm really triggered. I'm actually sizing him up to see where I would strike him if I had to take him down, because I can't walk away. He's in between me and the door. In my 20s, I took martial arts to help my inner 10-year-old feel more comfortable and capable. And I'm watching myself thinking this from the outside and saying, this isn't necessary, but the feeling of threat doesn't go away. I realize I'm deflecting his questions, and he won't stop short of asserting myself and setting the boundary. This is my house, my decision, and I don't like how I'm being treated. So finally, I get to fuck off in my head. The rage lives deep down and takes a while to bubble up. I realize I'm not breathing and exhale / partial laugh and blurt out, dude, I'm not appreciating the hard sell, as calmly as I could. My leg is shaking. I'm feeling hot in my face and chest. And I'm even feeling a little bad for calling him out, because I don't do it often enough. I feel fear around that, and double whammy shame about the fear. It's an edge for me. He backs off. There's an awkward pause. I offer some chit-chat and throw him a few tidbits of more info that I've decided I'm comfortable sharing to restore order. He pushes one more time, albeit much lighter. Him. So there's nothing I can do to earn your business today? Me. Nothing. End scene. He lost the sale specifically and only for that reason. And I am not ruminating because I'm proud of how I eventually handled the moment. This moment was such a small thing and probably hardly registered on this guy's radar as conflict, but in my mind, I was gearing up for all-out battle. Later, I was able to distill this interaction into him only pushing for and caring for his agenda without any concern for my agenda or my needs or concerns. He was all about getting what he wanted without regard to the other party and completely unable to read the room. I wonder if this is how some women feel sometimes when a man just tries to get something from them instead of wanting to share or partner with them. If there's a gift to be received from this moment that's deeper than my assertion win, I wonder if it could actually be feeling a split second of a woman's experience of the world that I can viscerally relate to and keep that in my consciousness. So part of what I love about this win is it's one of those moments that seems small, but is actually really big, because those moments when we feel pushed or we feel pressed and we're able to speak up for ourselves, we're able to assert ourselves, we're able to stand up for ourselves, that's part of what builds self-esteem. And being able to do that over time is eventually what gives us that sense of confidence, clarity, power in the world, really knowing that when the chips, you know, however the chips fall, I'm going to be able to assert myself. I'm going to be able to stand up for myself and really be there for myself, with myself. And I've seen countless of our clients go from not being able to do that to being able to do that. And the difference is really everything. And like I said, it's an ongoing, evolving opportunity for growth. It's not like one and done. It's just, okay, now I can do this. But those little moments matter. And I was really proud of this client for this moment. And I think that some of you out there will be able to relate to it. And I was happy to share it. So I'm excited to get into this episode now. And if you have any questions or comments, or if you have anything that resonated with you about that win, for example, and you wanted to maybe share something with the man in question, you can get me at dearmenpodcast@gmail.com and I can always pass something along. So without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode. I've been wanting to do this for a long time, so I'm very, very excited. Thank you for being with us. We have Lucas with us here today, who has actual personal experience using MDMA for intimacy and closeness with a relationship partner. And for those of you who aren't aware, you probably are because of the title, MDMA is what I would call a sacred medicine. So it is considered a psychedelic, even though it doesn't have hallucinogenic properties. But it was actually developed for couples. It was developed for couples counseling, and I mean, among other things. But I sort of think of that as it's one of its spiritual destinies as a chemical. And I've been wanting to hear someone's personal experience of using it therapeutically in relationship. So not just solo, but in relationship. So thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So yeah, I would love to hear about why you and your wife decided to embark on this journey of MDMA therapy. And if you could share a little bit about, you know, what sort of opened your mind to this? Because I would imagine that you probably weren't expecting to do something like this in your adult life. That's just my assumption. But can you share a little about your journey getting to a place where you're like, this could be good for us. This might be something that we should consider. How did you kind of arrive at that?
Yeah, that is an accurate assumption. I consider myself relatively square, so this was unusual, and certainly outside of what my wife Hannah and I would have considered. We originally were introduced to it actually by a couple friend of ours who were having challenges in their marriage and found their way to this as a way to start to bring themselves closer together. And what was interesting was these are actually dear friends of ours. They wound up ultimately separating. It wasn't related to the work that they did together. That actually really helped them do it much more amicably and in a way that, just watching them do it, I've not really seen a separation be quite so heartfelt and caring of the other. And so so it was difficult to see them not choose to be together, but we were really moved to see the effect that it had on the direction that separation took.
So it sounds like you were inspired by what they shared, despite the fact that they didn't necessarily make it as a couple. What was it? How did they describe their experience, and what had you sort of come to the conclusion that that might be helpful in your marriage? And were you the one to bring it up, or was it Hannah?
Yeah, it was me. But we both knew that they were doing this. I think what really intrigued the both of us was that as they told their story and shared the experience that they'd had, they both came back to some of the earliest feelings they'd had in their relationship, the kinds of feelings of love and the kind of unladen with the baggage or some of the things that can kind of build up over time. And they went back to some of that originality of their love. And that was really inspiring in particular to me because, you know, as where Hannah and I found ourselves was in a place where we were still really in contact with that. We'd been married about 6 years at the time. At this point, we had two children who at that point were, this is now, we're talking 18 months ago. So they would have been almost 3 and 5. And it kind of just come out of diapers in a way. Like we just moved past that initial phase of really little children where you have to be 100% on top of them to ensure that their needs are met and that they're being fed and clean and, you know, all that sort of stuff. They just had gotten to the point where they could spend a minute alone or more than a minute alone. And Hannah and I thought, gosh, this, I should say, I brought to her this idea of, how would it be as if this were the year as we come into 2023? This was at the end of 2022. What if 2023 was a year of turning back towards one another, turning back towards our relationship? We had become really productive partners in our marriage. We'd become really productive partners in our parenting. And we held great faith around our love for one another, but it wasn't something we were in contact with very regularly. And I was really missing that, and so that was my ask of her was could we try something to try and get back to that feeling that I know we both know is there, but that feels like we don't make contact with as much as I'd like.
I appreciate you speaking to that because I've heard that from many of our clients around, you know, feeling like we're effective co-parents, we get along, were productive, like you said, and I miss you. Mm. I miss the intimacy. I miss the closeness. I want that feeling of warmth and connection and love. And that's a tender thing to bring up with a partner. And I think a lot of our clients have really struggled with how do I even say it? I don't even necessarily know what to say because it sounds ridiculous to say I miss you when we spend 24/7 together and we're co-parents and we're just constantly doing things as a team. But there's a difference between doing things as a team and feeling that warmth, that intimacy, that closeness, that connection. So yeah, I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more to what that was like for you, because I think that's a common kind of felt experience. You know, what was there like a sense of longing or, and how was it when you would bring that up with Hannah? Was she super open to that? Did it ever feel like, oh, this is kind of a sensitive subject? Like, what was that experience like? Because I feel like so many men struggle with, I don't even know how to tell her this. It's like a hidden longing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the feeling that I recall most strongly was a sense of loneliness. And I experienced Hannah's love indirectly through what I saw her doing for our family and how I saw her loving our children. And there was a great deal of appreciation and gratitude that came in that form of her love. Like I really felt connected with her and appreciative of her and grateful to be in marriage and relation with her. And yet it still felt lonely. And it also felt kind of selfish to want something from her when it really felt like that would take something away from the children. That would take something away from my aspiration to support her professional ambitions. She's a impressive working mom. And So that was my, so I had to get out of my own way. So I think that was a little bit of what you were maybe alluding to, was I had to get out of my own way of asking for this. And actually, you know, we'll get into it, I guess, when we go further into the experience itself. But it turns out a lot of this work and being in connection with her and some of the insights that came through this work was getting out of my own way. But it started like before we even began the idea that we might try something like this.
Say a little bit more about what you mean by getting out of your own way. My interpretation is allowing yourself to actually want what you want or feel how you feel. But can you say a little more about
that? Yeah, sort of holding the appreciation for what she was doing for the family and what she was doing for me, while also recognizing like there's also something that's unmet in me that doesn't need to take anything away from what she's doing. It's not an indictment of her or of our relationship or of me in our relationship. We're both just doing the best we can and really putting our heart and soul into the kids, and they'll take everything that they can get, and that's what their job is. And we both kind of love that about them, but it was leaving us exhausted. And in the moments that we could claw back a little bit of time, we were investing it in ourselves and not in one another. And so it was just an appreciation that this is what was going on and that there wasn't anyone really at fault here. I didn't have to own responsibility for it to have this conversation with her. I didn't need to ask her to own responsibility for it. And we could approach it as just an exciting opportunity to bring something back that you know, maybe you too are feeling a lack of, but that which I am feeling a lack of, that sort of early love.
Yeah, I appreciate you speaking to that sense of loneliness within a marriage. That's something that we hear a lot from clients, and I think is something that can feel confusing, like you said, because, you know, bringing it up with a partner or whatever, I think it is easy to feel like defensive, right? For someone to get defensive or feel like I'm already trying to provide so much, I don't know what more I can give. Or, you know, I like what you said about getting out of your own way, being with what is true, which is both things can be true at the same time. I can be experiencing loneliness and we can both be doing our best. Like there's no, It doesn't mean that you're doing something wrong. And maybe there is something that we can do about it. And so enter sacred medicine and your couple friend, where I'm imagining that when you heard that from them, that they got to a place where they remembered the early days of just how much I like you, how much I like you as a person, how fun you are to hang out with, how fun our sexy time is, how much I look forward to seeing you, that closeness, again, that word closeness of the us time, us as a partnership or as a couple, not just as marriage partners raising children together. So, okay, so sacred medicine enters the picture and you bring this up as a possibility. And is she super receptive at first? She happened to have been there when you two were listening to this couple friend of yours. So that feels
That's right.
But yeah, can you say a little bit about how those conversations went of like, hey, would you be open to trying this? What do you think?
It's such a good question. And I can't say I remember all the detail of it. What I can say, I think it was pretty quick for us to decide. I think the framing of this as there's an opportunity for even more for us. From the outset, this was never there's a problem that needs fixing. That was just our personal experience. I want to appreciate that there's certainly ways in which this can certainly operate in that way as well, like in this other couple and in many other stories that I've heard since then. But for us, it was a little bit less threatening because for us, it was like, gosh, there's a potential here for something even greater, even better in this experience of love and this experience of being in connection and in relation to one another. And, I've often thought of my own therapy practice, going to therapy, being a recipient of therapy as a betterment of the well type of effort. And so that was some of the language we were using as we were talking about this. So it was, our framing was really a sort of an optimistic, hopeful one around what this could unlock, what sort of possibility was out there.
Awesome. So let's get into the logistics of it. So these medicines, and when I'm saying the word sacred medicine, I'm specifically thinking about MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, what is it called? Wachuma and other sacred medicines. And I'm going to drop in the show notes for those of you that are interested. There are a couple of really good documentaries on sacred medicine. And one is called How to Change Your Mind on Netflix, based on this book by the same title by Michael Pollan, which I have read and watched the series. So if you are interested in going deeper, there are lots of ways to learn how to do that. But I think that the fact is that we are currently in a gray zone around the legality of sacred medicine. So it's 2024 as of this recording, and there are certain states, there are certain cities where it has been decriminalized to the point where people are able to go to clinics and do this. And then there's an underground movement of often trained therapists and psychologists who are using this medicine in a therapeutic way with people and in an ethical therapeutic way, not just I'm taking Molly and rolling at a club. And that's what this conversation is, right? Is a therapeutic context. So how did you, I'm guessing you just asked your friends, but how did you find the practitioner you worked with? What was the sort of intake like? How did it work onboarding? You know, what was all of that like?
Yeah, we didn't actually ask them, not that we couldn't have, but I have had a long relationship with my personal therapist. And so I started with him and asked if he knew anyone, and it was distant for him at that point, but you know, there was enough of a network that he was able to put some feelers out. And I think we bounced a couple hops along the network before arriving at the introduction that we ultimately got. And boy, was that a lucky one. I think we found someone really special. What happened from that point was we were introduced and just began a little bit of an exploration of intent around it, and a little bit of learning about what was even involved here, since we had never done anything like this. And so the framework around which it goes is that there's a setup period, or a period of setting intentions and starting to just explore the topic, so that the therapist and us are sort of aligned on the objectives and the plan. And that typically, I think, would be sort of two or three sessions. We wound up doing about 6 months of preparation, meeting monthly. That was partly a function of the unavailability for the actual retreat date. The ceremony itself is a full day, and that it was just 6 months before this gentleman had availability. So we wound up going into sort of what might be a little bit more of a traditional couples therapy extended set and setting environment. And then we had a full day with him. And then there was some integration that followed. And as it turns out, we've kept up with the couple's work with him in the year that followed, and have subsequently done a second, retreat with him.
And I'm curious if you can share a little bit about, you know, when you were going through the intent and the sharing, what kinds of things were each of you bringing? What kinds of things were you talking about in the session? Because I think it's important. And I think that there's a way that your relationship dynamic might mirror some people that are listening. Can you share a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah. So for me, it was really around this question of loneliness. And in the earliest stages of it, I managed to get sort of past my own, you know, as we were talking about, getting past myself to be able to suggest this and move us into doing it. I still hadn't at that point taken full responsibility for that loneliness. So I was still hung up on, like, there's something that she needs to do in this, because we're in relation, we're in a marriage, and so my loneliness has something to do with how you're being. And so we started to unpack that a little bit. It wouldn't really be fully unpacked until we were in our day-long session with the medicine working with us. But that was the piece that I started to recognize as something that I was moving along and that would become part of this experience. I'll add, you know, it was funny in the year or so leading up to this, like, just to give you a sense of this sense of loneliness, I was having, I was probably having a dream a week for perhaps a year before our experience together, where Hannah was leaving me in some form or another. And I was left with just this sort of desperate flailing of, what does a life look like without her? Where do I even begin? Like, the pieces were so smashed. It was like it was a terrifying experience. And it left me out of contact with her. Like the response that I had to that was like protective response, which was, you know, how can I start to prepare for something like that, or not make it as painful as it's feeling in these dreams. And so that was contributing to this. And so it was a big deal to start talking about that with her. That was the first time that I mentioned it was in the context of this sort of safer space with a therapist there. So so the work really did begin early, like before we were in there. But the breakthroughs really came in the session. One of the things that, you know, just as a funny little backstory, the gentleman who led us is an incredible man, and he was a couples therapist for like 30 plus years. And when he discovered MDMA therapy for couples, he basically transitioned his entire practice to doing this work. And his experience of it was, we get a year's worth of impact with couples in a single day. And he's committed himself and his practice to that work now since discovering it. I also think it's really special to have someone who is so steeped in couples work. That was really meaningful, and I felt the power of that part of him in the non-ceremony elements of his supporting us.
I'm tearing up right now because I've heard similar things from therapists and mental health professionals kind of across the board, that these kinds of medicines can speed up the process of therapy and can lead to breakthroughs that would otherwise take years. And to me, it feels like that is such a needed element in our world. We need more efficient ways to help people heal and to help people grow and to help people come together. And so I'm really glad that you spoke to that, and I'd potentially be interested in having him on the podcast if he's available, because there's something inherent to the medicines themselves. And then there's also who is holding the space around the medicines. We're not going to get into the other medicines on this episode, but I'm deeply appreciating what you're saying here and what you're sharing and bringing, because having a very experienced couples therapist who is holding you through this experience is going to be very different than an inexperienced person who doesn't know as much. And so there's you're getting a lot of bang for your buck in what you're describing. But I think that's really significant to just pause on and appreciate that a very experienced person has said, we've gotten so much done in these sessions that I'm transitioning my entire practice to this, because I've been doing it for 30 years and I can say, you know, and if you watch the series that I was mentioning, you listeners, if you watch it, you will see a very similar sentiment being expressed with the couples therapists involved in the original MDMA research that was then criminalized, and how much grief came up for them when it was criminalized, because they knew the cost of that. They knew what the cost of that was going to be, which was a lot of healing work was going to be not on the table anymore until it was legalized again, which is basically the process that we're in right now. So, okay. So you did a bunch of prep work, and then, and I think I also want to acknowledge your bravery in bringing up that the dreams and that insecurity in those sessions, because that would be really hard to bring up. And I'm just curious to hear, what was Hannah's response to that? Was she surprised? Did she have any idea? And like, what was that part like? Because that happened even before you did the ceremony.
Yeah, she was surprised. I'd been really private about that. It felt like so scary to bring to her, and I was still just making sense of it myself. So she was surprised. She was, really sad to hear it. I mean, that was not where she was at, and so she took it really seriously, and that was a sad thing for her to hear. And I think what was really, I gotta say, Mel, I'm starting to lose track of what was part of the conversations before the session itself, and some of the insights that came out from it. But there was also an awareness from her, experienced as a need from me, that was constricting. like she wouldn't have known that this is the experience I was having, but what she was aware of was a sense of like graspiness from me. And that was doing its own damage for her and was its own weight and a source of disconnect in the relationship for her was this sort of desperation or neediness around her in a particular kind of way from me.
Yeah, thank you for speaking to that, because that's a common experience that I've also heard from many of the men that we work with. And it's not necessarily definable, right? It's not like necessarily easy to talk about, but there's just a feeling, there's a sense sometimes from a partner around it. And it's like, I don't know what that is or what to do with that on both sides, right? I'm the one feeling needy, or I'm the one experiencing this person as feeling needy. And there's sort of like, I'm not really sure what to do about this. I know that it's not working for me the way that it is, or it's feeling like too much, or, you know, I'm not sure what Hannah's experience of it was, but I think that's important to highlight because a lot of people have that experience in relationship. And I don't think this is necessarily as true for you, but in my experience, because of the patriarchy, many, many men are very isolated. So they're not getting a lot of connection needs met with their friends. They don't see their guy friend. I'm specifically talking about connection with other male friends, with other men, solid, safe, supportive men. Many of our clients don't have any men like that in their lives, or they used to have them, but they're also married with kids and there's no time. They don't see them. They don't have any connection. So all of their connection needs are falling on their wife, on their spouse. And so whenever there's that much, strain on a single relationship, of course there's going to be pressure there because there's so much riding on it. I think sort of to your point about, shit, if this goes away, that's my whole world versus a net of people, right? And especially I think about this a lot in terms of co-living and the way that we live. When we used to live with extended family, there were a lot more human beings around that we shared space with, that we shared food with, that we shared opinions with, that we felt connected to and close to. There was more of a web. There was more of a net. We don't live that way anymore. So it's very easy to engage in codependent dynamics, basically, because that's your whole world is this person. And I think especially when you're raising kids, right? That's your only adult conversation during the day if you work from home or, you know, whatever. There's so much riding on it. And it didn't always used to be that way. So there's something unique that we're living through. They're calling it the post-extended family era, the modern post-extended family era, that I think puts even more pressure on romantic relationships. And I think that's even more true for men. If you look at the statistics, men tend to be more lonely. They tend to have fewer social connections, fewer close friends. And because of the patriarchy, it's less socially acceptable to be close with other men, right? A lot of the conversations are surface level. You're not getting down into the depths. You seem like someone who has a lot of close male friends, and still there's still this happening in your relationship. So thank you for speaking to that. I think a lot of people will resonate with that as part of their story.
Yeah, I think what you described is was ultimately part of the part of my work following our session as well too, was to really be thoughtful about bringing myself more into contact with those men and finding ways to satisfy the desire for intimacy and connection and love with people beyond just my wife. And funny enough, it's enhanced my ability to do that with the kids, with my mom, with the men in my life. So it's been broader than just men, but the biggest delta in the pre and post has been the time and intimacy with other men. And that continues to be true for me now today. I'm in a men's group this year, and that's something I've never done before. I know you've talked about that on your show, Mel, and that was sort of where it first came onto my radar. And I didn't recognize the relationship to what we're talking about now until we went through this. And then sort of here I am, you know, a year and a half later, find myself sort of in the first 2 months of doing work with other men, doing men's group work.
And I'm curious, you know, I think I know the answer to this, but are you finding that is meeting some of your connection needs? It is meeting some of your intimacy needs, and it is sort of reducing that pressure on the relationship with your wife? Like, is it helping with the loneliness?
It is. It is a lot. one of the pieces that I felt was the most potent for me coming out of this session, the integration was really important. And then the support in the year that followed with my personal therapy was absolutely irreplaceable. And that's where I got to practice all of the insights that came up in the session, where I got to practice and have a weekly opportunity to reflect on where it had gone well, where I was feeling it wasn't going as well. But with the clarity that had come through in our session, it was able to spool that out over the course of the following year to enact that change into life. It was not like this thing was fixed the day of. The insights arrived the day of, and then the work began. And, you know, for both Hannah and I, she was not seeing a therapist prior to this and began seeing one afterwards. I have been seeing one for nearly 20 years now, the same man. And for both of us, the insights of that day together were equally as important about what we learned about ourselves in relation as it was about our relationship. And so it basically established the agenda for the year that followed in our own personal therapy work.
Thank you for speaking to that. And we're going to get to integration after you share about what the actual session was like. But I really love what you said about the insights arrived the day of, and then the work began. And that tracks with a lot of my own experience with sacred medicine and the people that I know, is that you can arrive at a conclusion, or something can be elucidated. I see this now. This is something that I am aware of. And then you need to take action on it. So both steps are necessary, because if you haven't seen it, if you don't know, then you can't take action on it. So in this case, for example, if you hadn't come to that awareness around, I need to have more of my connection needs met, they're not being met. That's what's so right now. But rather than it all being about your wife, there was more insight around, okay, I need more of this need to be met. Now, how do I do that? How do I get more of my connection needs met? What do I bring in? What do I bring into my life in order for that to be true? And that was where working with a mentor on a regular basis and you know, developing those conclusions and then taking action on them and then reflecting on the action. How is this going? What is coming up for me here? That's a lot of the work. I really love that Hannah started seeing a therapist after this as well. That feels really important. And because that's the truth, right? Is like each person is coming with their own set of things that are happening. And then there's what's happening between the two of you. So both people need support. They need mentorship in different ways and often together as well. And that's all part of the equation. It's not like any one thing is going to fix everything. It doesn't work like that. It's like everything works together, almost like a garden, to have it flourish.
Absolutely. And there's something a little, you know, at the slightly meta level around recognizing that there's my work to do in this. There's something about doing it in the context of personal therapy that requires a degree of ownership about how I was in relationship with her and how I was the source of some of my own pain. And taking responsibility for that is hard. That's where the medicine helped. But it's also empowering, because then once it's yours, you can do something about it. So I almost think of the ceremony as being so profound because it got me past the challenge of accepting this and responsibility for it. Once I arrive at the sense of responsibility for it, I can then tap a sense of excitement around that, because now it's in my court. I can do, that's something I can action without waiting on anyone, without relying on anyone. That's not to say that there isn't also work that we do together, but that was exciting to find parts of it for which I was responsible and could take responsibility.
And just to slow that down a little, I think what I'm hearing is, and I think a lot of men will resonate with this, is I'm trying to get my needs met from you, my wife. I'm trying to get my needs met. I'm trying to get connection needs met. And I feel kind of dependent upon you, whether you give them to me or not, equals whether I get them met or not. So there's a sense of a lack of agency and a certain sense of dependence and helplessness versus, oh, I have connection needs. They're mine. They're not her responsibility to give to me. They're mine. And if they're mine, then I have ownership over where I get them met, when I get them met. There's more of the locus of control comes back into me, into the center of me, instead of it's over there and I'm busy trying to get it all the time, which is exhausting and discouraging. Is that kind of what we're talking about?
That's exactly right. That was, you know, what I learned, you know, perhaps the biggest single lesson for me in our ceremony was that my need to be loved by Hannah in a particular way was preventing her from loving me the way that she wanted to love me. And so I was blocking her from doing her own kind of loving on me because I was coming to her with a need for a different kind of love, the kind of love that either she wasn't recognizing or wasn't ready to give or didn't want to give or didn't feel like the way that she knew to give. And so once that was understood, once I got that, it was like, wow, okay, so that's my thing. I understand myself now better. I understand that need and how I can get that met. And also, gosh, what a relief to be able to lift this off of her, this woman I love, and who it was a painful insight to recognize that I was suffocating her in some ways around this with this need of mine, both in relation to her loving me and potentially in relation to the kids. Take something away from her capacity to love in the world when I'm like hoovering up with this neediness, like the love in a way that really just taxes her. So that was a big deal. That was a really big deal. That was my biggest insight.
Yeah, that is a huge insight. And I imagine it's very win-win what you're talking about, because I would imagine it also freed you up to see all the ways that she does love you and all the ways that she wants to love you. And that would be a relief. When I imagine being you, I feel relieved. Like, okay, no, she really does love me. It might not look like this, but there is a lot of love and a lot of care and security, I think, that comes with that, of just emotional security around that. So yeah, let's get into ceremony.
I'm smiling. What you said is just right. I'm smiling. Oh,
good. I'm glad. Yeah, people can't see, so that's helpful. Yeah, tell me about the actual day of ceremony. What was it like? You know, particularly, you know, people are going to want to know, did you feel high? You know, what is you self-described as someone who's a little bit square. And I think that a lot of listeners will also resonate with that, where it's like, I would never, this is what I was told not to do for my whole life. I was always told not to do drugs. And I keep calling it sacred medicine for a reason, which is, I don't consider this a drug, particularly not when it's used in a therapeutic context. But what was it like for both of you? Because I would say that, you know, my guess is that she also probably self-describes as square. And, you know, what was ceremony like?
Yeah, that was a barrier. It's getting past the whole like education from high school that this particular thing, that MDMA, what I remember is it turns your brain into Swiss cheese, puts holes in your brain, right? That was what I remembered from middle school and high school being told about this, and why I'd never done it, why I stayed so far away from it. So we wound up, it was a Friday, we made it a weekend. So we had Friday night, we had Thursday evening. We got away Thursday afternoon, and we had Thursday evening, Friday all day with our guide. And then we had all day Saturday and Saturday night on our own. And then we left Sunday midday. We found a cute little Airbnb, somewhere that was private, that was kind of surrounded by trees and felt really immersed in nature, something that just felt comfortable and safe. We liked that it was small. It just sort of created a small interior space, which mirrored the sense of intimacy and coming together that we were seeking. We were met at about 9 o'clock in the morning or so with our guide. And we began with picking up from a conversation that we'd started with him the night before on Thursday evening around intentions. He surprised us both and offered us the opportunity to draw a tarot card, which is like about as far from anything I've ever imagined myself doing. And it was a really interesting nexus of suggestion as we were setting into this. Like it did add some intrigue and some ceremony, and some actual, like, there was something about what we each got in that was interesting. I can talk about that if you want later. So, okay. So here we are in that morning. We were sitting together, the three of us in a circle. I think he had some copal or something that he burned. It's like an incense type of thing. And there was some ceremony around it. He led us in a meditation. He did a little bit of gentle something between humming and chanting kind of thing. We spoke our intentions together. We created an altar. There happened to be a little bit of a fireplace in this thing. So we brought a couple things from our wedding, some photos from the wedding, some drawings from our children, a sign that was at our wedding, like carved into the wood, a couple other little things. And he brought a few things. So we sort of decorated this altar, and it served as a bit of a centerpiece and a place where we placed our intentions. Like, as we were speaking our intentions, we were placing them into this altar. And, you know, there was something that was sort of joyful about this. It was sort of outside of the realm that I normally operate to have this altar here and to be doing this kind of stuff. I have done some meditation. I'm doing more of it since then, but that was also a little bit newer for me then. So there was something that was distinctly ceremonial about it that felt different. Like, this is not normal life, right? This feels different. And that really added to the experience. It added to the focus. So, after we had begun our intentions, we took the medicine. I'm going to guess it was probably around 10 or 10:30 or so. And his suggestion was that at that point we separate and spend the next hour in separate rooms. He had invited us to write a letter to one another. We had done that the night before, but I hadn't written mine into the card. So I spent that time and then did some meditation. Hannah just spent the time meditating. And it was about it's 45 minutes to an hour for it to come on. And it was right around that time. I was in the same room as our guide. And so I was sitting with him for this time. And right towards the end of it, I had what I would describe as the only sort of bumpiness that I had going into the experience. And in retrospect, as I've understood more about how these things work and heard other people's stories and have had some time to integrate my own, I think this was something of the point that I was getting past my own ego. Something Michael Pollan and others call that like the ego death. I think it was something akin to that, but it was an experience that I'd felt we had been asked the night before about prayer, and I don't have a prayer practice, and it felt quite foreign to me. And then here I was in this moment, just as I was coming into this, and I had the kind of hot flash I've never had before. I just instantly felt burning through my whole body. Sweat instantly was created on my face. A moment of nausea. It felt really overwhelming. And I did the only thing I know to do, which was to get into a child's pose. I think I may have been prompted, or maybe I did that on my own. But in any event, you know, I went from the meditative seating to like child's pose. And it passed really quickly. But what I later observed was what a prayer position that is, like going into child's pose with one's head down and arms forward. So I was just struck by this notion that I had sort of rejected this idea the night before. And then suddenly that was the threshold I had to cross through. There was something of giving myself up, like relaxing, not needing to hang on my own stories, my own understanding of myself. There was like letting go of that. That's how I understood what I now hear people saying of like letting go or surrender to it. It was a letting go of my conviction that I was right, or my conviction that I knew what the hell was going on in my own head or about my feelings, and being open to something new. And so from that point on, I was in it. We had this beautiful moment where he brought us back together and like just instant reconnection to like the deepest parts of the love that I remember for Hannah, and the experiences of our love over the entirety of the 10 plus years that we've known each other and been together, from the early dating time to the decision to have a child, to the birth of the child, to celebrating her professional successes, to having my accomplishments celebrated, like all of these different ways that we loved each other sort of all arrived at the same time. And it was truly heart-opening. Like, it was almost more than I could bear. I think we both sort of had tears come into our eyes when we were directed to sit down together. And we sat down on the couch facing one another and just had a beautiful, I don't know, 30 seconds or a minute, just looking at one another. She rested her head on my chest, I think, shortly after that. And Henna is not one for physical acts of public displays of affection, or affection is not sort of her love language. And so that was really meaningful to feel her move towards me in that way and place her head on my chest. And that was how we started. That was sort of the starting point when the starting gun went off. As we sort of both entered in, it was just, we were immediately in a different place. And, you know, I just wanted to specifically answer your question about the, like, what's the feeling? I smoke marijuana and been very, drunk at times in my life. And, you know, I experience those as like non-normal states of mind. They feel very altered. And what was so different about this was it felt really sober. I was just in my feelings. I was really in contact with my sense of love for her. There was nothing, it felt expansive, not like it was putting a filter over what I was thinking or saying or interpreting from her, but just an opening. So it felt, I felt clear-eyed, clear-eyed and open-hearted, really.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's misunderstood about a medicine like MDMA, is particularly because of the way that it was represented in the media of rolling on Molly at a club, rolling on ecstasy or Molly at a club, is it was sort of portrayed as similar to being drunk. But that's not actually what this medicine does. And I appreciate your description of it, of being clear-eyed and open-hearted, because I think at its best, it is, you're completely lucid on it. It's not like other medicines, part of what it's doing physiologically is it's reducing the activity of the amygdala in the brain. And the amygdala is responsible for our fear and rage response. So many of our defense mechanisms come from the amygdala. When we feel like we need to defend ourselves, we show up differently. When we feel safe and secure and open, we show up differently. And this is a medicine that can help people, couples, show up with each other without the habitual guards, which is a big deal, because that can be so ingrained over time, right? If you've started to do certain roles with each other, certain dynamics, that can go on for years, decades even, and you don't even necessarily know you're doing it anymore. It's just how you are with each other. And this is a pattern interrupt of, we're going to take those responses, those defensive or habitual sort of responses away, and what is possible in that space. And I was really moved by what you said of, it was meaningful to feel her move towards me, because I think that's something that I feel and hear from many of the men that I work with, is the longing for that of, I just want to feel her move towards me. I want to feel her want me. I want to feel her care. And this can be a space where that unfolds. And it feels like very much for you too, that was also part of the intention of what you were coming in with. That was part of what you were wanting. And so there's a co-creation there. But, you know, I love what you said about an immediate reconnection, right? There was no sort of like, it's just like, oh yeah, it's right here. It's right here. It's been here. It might have gotten a little clouded, but it's right here. It's vivid. It's happening. I'm curious if you can share a little bit about, you know, the ride that you then went on with your guide, because I'm sure your guide took you through exercises or prompts or ways of talking about things that you'd already talked about. How much of the session was talking versus connecting just with eye gazing and contact and things like that? Because those are both equally valuable. And, you know, it's a long session, right? I mean, most of the people that I know that have done it, it's 4 to 6 to 8 hours. So it's not like a half an hour experience.
Yes. Yes, that's right. So it's probably like 11 a.m. now. And we sort of would be wrapping by probably 4:30 that day. So we had like 5 hours. It's like a five hour experience. And we had about an hour after the moment that I just described, we had a little boost. So we had maybe 25 or 35% of the original amount again, which can stretch it out. So, you know, as it relates to this therapist, our guide, he he was in and out. He was with us the entire time. And then he was giving us a lot of space at times, and then at times bringing us back to conversations that we had expressed intent around wanting to have or go to. And so what was really neat about that was that we spent time on the stuff that felt important, but there was the space to get into things that I don't think either of us expected to come up. And so, and, you know, even like things that we probably hadn't, things that we certainly hadn't shared with him because they weren't sort of front or top of mind, but started to, we started to recognize we're part of it. So, how do we go from here? Shall I just sort of share a couple of the insights and the sort of situations that precipitated them?
Yeah, and I would definitely be interested if you remember about what a few of those bonus content things ended up being, because I'm curious, because they probably arose naturally, and that's part of what I think medicine can help with, is helping our intuitive thoughts or feelings come to the surface. So they've always been there, but it helps them come up and in this case, be shared with someone that you love and care about, where for some people, it can feel really hard to share. Getting the words out, right? Communicating for many, many people is vulnerable. And if they didn't see that modeled, it's really hard for them. And I have heard, and I'm curious to hear from you, you know, that for the partner who's maybe not as open or not as skilled at revealing or being vulnerable, that this can help them with that. Did you two find that to be the case? And what were some of the bonus things that came up? Because I think we're all curious to hear.
Yeah. Well, you know, perhaps just one thing to share before we get there, because it was sort of the core experience for me on my side of it, was just as we had sat down and we were facing one another, you know, great sort of credit and thanks to Hannah for sort of initiating and bootstrapping my process of learning to love myself, was she came to me with her love. And so one of the things that I remember more clearly than anything from this whole experience was her saying, "I will never leave you. I will never leave you. I will never leave you." She repeated it. And it just filled me up. It was an experience I've never had before. It just filled me up. And it basically like allowed me to bootstrap my process of learning to love myself, of learning to find love in more diverse places, and in knowing that she was there. And it sort of created for me this insight of what kind of life could I live if I was never afraid that I would be alone? And I've never had that question before. I've long known that my deepest fear has been being alone. I've known that for 10 plus years, but I think simultaneously, like she met that need and gave to it incredibly generously, and also like invited me, taught me, empowered me to go and do something for myself about it in that, because I knew she was there, and it resolved for me this fear that I would be alone. And so I have carried that every day since that moment. That was for me the most profound feeling that I had in that, and then the opportunities that had opened for me have been big for our relationship and big for me.
Yeah. Part of what I hear in that is secure attachment.
Yeah.
We talk about attachment theory all the time, and there's so much out there about attachment theory, and there's something about, okay, but how do we actually get to secure attachment? Like, we talk a lot about anxious avoidance and, you know, what is it called? Not detached, but there's some other complex, or there's all these different words around the topic, but to me it's like, what are the practices that help us get to secure attachment? And when I hear that story, part of what I hear is the generosity and the care and the love and the regard on her side in knowing what you needed to hear, and then being in such an open-hearted space to really let that in. Because I imagine her saying it casually in your bedroom on a Saturday night would be different than in sacred space, looking into each other's eyes, repeating it. To me, it's like, that is secure attachment. That is going to build secure attachment. This is what this person really needs to hear. And I can provide this kind of security because I really am not going anywhere, right? You don't want to say it if you don't mean it. You can only say things like that ethically if you mean them. And I think that's one of the most beautiful parts of healthy, long-term committed partnership is this person has become your family. They are not your bio family, but they have become your family. And it's sort of a corroboration of, yes, I'm your family. I'm not going anywhere. This is something safe and secure that you can rely on. And when you said what you said about going out and meeting your own needs, you know, outside of the relationship, what it made me think of was secure attachment in children does not look like the child gazing at the parent. Secure attachment in children is they know that dad is there and they can go back to dad if they get hurt, but they're out exploring the world. That's secure attachment. It's that I know I have this rock solid thing in my corner in case something happens. Therefore, I can go do things. Secure attachment is not gazing at each other. It's exploring and knowing I have you to come back to. You are a rock in my life. So that just felt like reflective of that experience.
I appreciate that language you give to it. That's a fresh understanding the way you describe it, and I deeply resonates.
So take us through, you know, the guided conversation. I'm imagining that part was not guided, that particular section. You had already done a lot of prep work, and it sounds like your guide was very attuned in coming in and out of guiding versus letting you be on the ride together and having the experiences that you're going to have. Yeah, take us through kind of the flow of what you remember of the day.
Yeah, so that was sort of where we began. And after that, our guide started to bring that was just so nourishing, and it just opened me. And I, as I think back on it, I think we all recognize that. And it was a little longer than what I just described. There was a bit more of being with that, but then that provided the basis with his prompt to then move and turn back towards Hannah and around what she needed. And part of that was her being able to talk about the ways in which there was this smothering effect from my need for her, and the cost that carried for her. Like, it was really articulated in ways that I hadn't heard. And with this openness, I didn't feel defensive. It could really land on me. And so it carried tremendous weight to hear these ways that she was carrying this weight or suffering by it, or that it was leaving her less resource to be with her friends or to have alone time, which is really important to her, and which this was the primary cost to her was that this was taking away her alone time. She was giving up herself to meet me in this need. And that was also violating boundaries of hers. And, you know, we weren't at the stage of resentment, but that's the kind of pattern that could ultimately lead to something like that. And so she was able to let me hear all that, and I was able to take it all in a way that would have been, you know, perhaps too painful to hear were it not for the environment that we were in there. It was okay to hear all that, and I didn't feel a sense of like I need to solve this right now. I didn't feel a sense of I'm a bad person for having done this. I didn't feel a sense of like collapse Yeah, I guess those would be the two, like no need to spring to action and no need to like collapse into guilt. Just be here and be there with her in it and take it in and understand it. And it gave me just a much deeper understanding of what it feels like to be on the other side of my love and my need for love. And I didn't like that. It was real, you know, once I was able to bring that inside and see what that felt like, I didn't like that. That wasn't the experience I would have wanted for her or for myself or for anyone. And so that was really powerful for creating the conditions for what I needed to, for what I was doing and why I would ultimately want to work towards being different.
I really appreciate how you articulated that. And I'm struck by the slowing down part, right? That I think that there's a way that the medicine helped both of you slow down. And I really liked what you said about, I didn't feel a sense of, I need to solve this right now. I need to solve this right now. Or I'm a bad person because she feels this way. And that's such a common place to jump to when I think when couples are trying to do this kind of thing alone, it's like hearing a painful truth immediately can put us into that, oh, I've got to do something about this, or I can't believe I've been, quote, doing this to you for this long, and all of that guilt and shame. And can you just speak a little bit to like, what did that feel like? What did that feel like to not have those responses online? Could you feel them in the background and they're just not there? Or, I mean, it's just so different from regular life. Like, yeah. Did you notice, wow, this is really different to just be able to hear this right now? Like, what was that actually like?
You know, I did not have any meta process that was doing analysis at that stage. It was an experience of being really present and really dialed in. And I will say the experience I had of it was one of sadness. Like I was inhibiting the space that I saw her in and feeling the pain of that and the pain of that. The pain of that. And there was something beautiful about that. There was something really unique about, I consider myself an empathetic person, Mel, but this was a kind of empathy that I haven't manifested myself. And so in this context, with the aid of the medicine, here I was really feeling into something in the moment, just in the moment, how that would feel for her. And it felt sad. It felt sad. It felt heavy. I felt some of the oppressiveness of it. And you know, that brings us to some of the sort of surprise insights in that. One of the sources of pain that I think we kind of both knew it was there, but we dealt with it a little bit, and then it was more comfortable not to like fully engage on it. But I had an impropriety with her at the start of our very, very start of our relationship. And I had never really taken full responsibility for it. And so in this state, I was able to see that there was still some hurt there for her and make contact with my responsibility for that. And just the sadness, the hurt, just the hurt. And I think it was really meaningful to Hannah for me to meet her there, because it had been such a scary and foreboding place, I think.
Yeah, thank you for speaking to that, because that's such a good example of, you know, you've been together for years, you have kids together, you're deeply committed, and this kind of space that gets created allows for older hurts or pains or resentments or just hurt, like you said, to be fully integrated and processed instead of halfway. Like, okay, we dealt with that. Like, we're good. It's fine. And maybe we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to touch on a sensitive spot. We don't want to go back to that. But if it's not fully healed and it's not fully repaired, there's always that just kind of sense of something a little bit off. And that's a really sacred thing to bring that forward. I would imagine that maybe she was the one who brought it up of, I'm still holding on to this, or this is still something that's present for me and alive for me. And the reason to bring it up is because it's blocking the flow of love. Mm-hmm. It's blocking the flow of love. There's something in the way, there's a block to me fully surrendering to you or fully trusting you or fully allowing you in, is this thing happened right at the beginning. And I closed a little part of myself off. Like, I never really fully opened the aperture the same way after that. And we repaired to the extent that we could at the time, but now there's this deeper layer and an ability. You know, what you are describing in being deeply present is deep empathy. What I'm hearing is deep empathy of, wow, I'm getting a sense of what it's like to be you. I'm getting a sense of what it's like to be you, to feel your feelings, to know what it is to be you. And I think so often we confuse empathy with sympathy, which is, oh, I feel for you. I'm so sorry that happened to you. That's very different than, wow, I'm feeling the impact. I'm imagining what that was, and I'm actually feeling it in my heart, in my body. And to be met in that place by a partner is a different kind of thing than an intellectual exercise.
Yes, to all of that. Yes. There was also something about that being the most scary place to go. And to be able to go there suddenly opened up, and we went there, you know, relatively early, suddenly opened up everything. After that, everything else, there are other hurts. There are smaller ones. There's other little things that, where we've stepped on one another or done little things. And suddenly everything came into play because this one that was the most painful, that was the most scary to go back to was made available and opened up.
I think there's something profound about that. And again, because there's a space that's created where my defenses aren't up, I'm not guarded in the same way. There's a safety that's created there, and it's mutual. We're both in that place. And there's a guide there as well, right? There's also someone else that's holding the space, but that feels like part of why, to me, these kinds of medicines, and this one in particular, is such a helpful tool because it helps with these deeper conversations. They're deeper conversations that need to happen, and they can be damaging. They can be really hard. They can touch on really sensitive spots if we're not ready to be open-hearted with our partner and able to meet them and truly empathize. So it's a tool. It's like a way of helping with that so that we can go to the depths safely together and come out safely together. So as we're starting to move through the journey, I don't want to rush you or anything, but it feels like this opened up a lot. That moment opened up like a lot of other areas and things. And then what happened as you were sort of starting to come out of the experience? And then let's talk about integration, because there was a lot of material, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yes. Once we kind of had, I would describe that there was almost a sense of exhaustion after a couple hours. You know, 2 to 3 hours in, we'd spent a lot of time. We'd cried a lot. We'd hugged a lot. We'd laughed a couple times. We were in physical contact. There was a little bit of body soreness because we're sitting on the couch and sometimes leaning on each other in cuddles that you suddenly realize this is uncomfortable. So, you know, there was a little bit of exhaustion. And as we started to transition, one thing that was really neat was the aperture of like this idea of love and where it lived in each of us grew to include other people. And so our children came in to the conversation, most significantly and perhaps most surprisingly, her parents and my mom and another couple who's very dear to us came into the conversation. And we wound up writing lengthy letters to each of these five people, the two people in this couple, Hannah's mom and dad and my mom, and reading them aloud to them, sort of a la the way that we would read the letters to one another. And that was a really unexpected and amazing extension of the work that we were doing with our love to one another, to suddenly see it come out into the world and show itself in this way of increased capacity and interest and desire to be in connection and communicate that love that we felt with these five special people. So that was sort of our second half, you might call it. And you know, we had a really beautiful moment where we read these letters to one another. There's nothing quite like, I think you could do this in a variety of settings, but the next time, I've now taken up the habit of reading cards to people and no longer writing them and passing them to them as a result of this experience. But reading a card to someone is next level. So we did that for one another, and that was just sort of a cherry on top kind of experience. At that point, we felt like we'd moved through some of the harder stuff and we're starting to land a little bit. And then it was just this beautiful expression of appreciation for each other.
There's something really special about that, because it also reflects your love in a wider context in the greater community and, you know, strengthening the web. We are part of each other's lives, but we're also part of other people's lives. And this is really, I think, an important point, because our culture does focus so much on kind of like the couple bubble and just, you know, you and me, but the healthiest, strongest relationships have a lot of ties to other people. And recognizing and honoring that, that just feels like a beautiful representation of what else is possible. So let's talk about integration after the session. You know, I'm sure you needed some rest. And then I'm sure there were, you know, follow-up sessions. Can you share a little, was there afterglow? Was there a crash after? I think that's something that some people are concerned about sometimes. Talk to me about the after effects.
Yeah, there was both. I think the more pronounced one was the crash, though. And that was... So that evening we went to sleep. We hadn't eaten all day. One of the protocols in this particular one is that you fast. And so here we are at sort of five. I think he left us between 5 and 6 p.m. and he left some fruit and nuts and stuff out. And we kind of sat there just feeling really quite shot through, just exhausted, kind of nibbling on a little bit of food, not particularly hungry, but recognizing we probably should eat something, and then went to bed early. I think we were probably in bed by 7:30 or 8. This happened to take place in the winter, so it was dark, so that was nice, and we went to sleep. The next day was a little bit of a melancholy day, I think I would say, and we'd been told to expect that. We'd had some supplements that lightened that just a little bit, and so we'd been told to. I haven't done it without them, so I don't know what exactly the effect of them were, but It was just a really slow day. We held no objectives for the day. It was just a quiet day. I think the piece that felt the most melancholy for me was we just come from this place of deep connection and just feeling such expansiveness and feeling a return to the normal, which included a little bit of closure around some of that openness, felt like a bit of a loss. And so I experienced a little bit of loss and grief around that. And then you're also just sort of exhausted, I think, emotionally, mentally, physically, such that it felt really down energy. You can probably speak better to the sort of chemical process that's going on, but I think you've sort of exhausted some of the serotonin or dopamine or something in your brain in the course of this. And so it was just a really quiet day. And at times, aspects of the pre came up. Like, because we were both quieter, there wasn't as much energy for expressing the love for one another. And so I found I had to be really thoughtful about not going back to that place of loneliness that I was remembering, or not going back to the sense of disappointment or wanting or need. And that was kind of, but I understood, at least I understood it as my work. That was the distinction. I understood that. I now understood that that was my pattern and that this is something that I could hold, that there would be integration sessions coming up where we could talk about this, that she would be going through her own version of this. And the last thing that would be productive would be for me to come and, you know, bring that need back in again. So it was manageable, but it was uncomfortable. And I think that's worth knowing for folks, because it wasn't just like a silver bullet fix after that experience. There was a period afterwards that felt a little bit slower and sadder and not as connected, and the disappointment that comes with that. And then there was, like, you know, the year of work that followed it that really was where we started to live into it. We still are. Here we are 18 months out. We've done one more with this, with the same incredible therapist, and we're still working it. It's our relationship work. But the difference is it feels really good to do it together. Now it feels like an investment in one another instead of something that is compulsive or like needs fixing or help. It's sort of there's a fun and an appreciation for it and a celebration of sorts in it, as well as it, but it is work. It continues to be work.
I really like the way you described that. That feels like a very healthy and mature and measured description of it, because it's it's like, okay, now we get to invest in this together. Now this is a ride. This is an adventure that we're taking together. And we recognize that it's going to take a while, and we're still in it. But that's very different from, I feel really separate from you in this. I don't know how to reach you in this. I don't know how to talk to you about this. There's a sense of being on the same team or being inside it together rather than separate. Would you say that's a fair characterization?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And I think that makes all the difference, because when we feel like we're on a team with our partner, even if we're doing something hard, that's fundamentally different than we're not on a team. I'm kind of on my own and I'm trying to reach you and it's not working. That's just not a fun place to be. So I think that's an inspiring takeaway.
So yeah, that's really beautifully said.
Thank you. So we're going to start to wrap here. I think that if you could sort of share any advice that you have for folks out there that might be thinking, I think this could really serve our relationship. I think this could really be good for us. How to approach a partner with it? I mean, obviously you can share this episode with them, but how would you, as someone who has been through this, recommend that people talk to a partner about doing this with them?
Yeah. I think I would encourage starting from a place of not self-orientation, non-self-orientation. And so I think what that looks like is around curiosity and inquiry with a partner, with your motive can be laid bare. I think I could imagine sharing it as a suggestion, but then starting with inquiry rather than suggestion or pushiness and curiosity about how it lands for the other person and what they make of it and what sounds exciting or not. And if there's resistance, I think the one thing I can say about this is if there's resistance in someone, it's going to harm the experience together. And so being in, I think, is important. And so I would imagine my responsibility as a partner who was eager for it with a partner that wasn't as holding space for that part of them that is resistant and making that okay and being patient. Big part of my lesson in this has been patience. Like I'm understanding patience on a totally different time scale than I used to. My kids taught me that patience is like 15 minutes, so that instead of like right now, it's like I can go and shout outside 15 minutes from now instead of front in front of them. And in the context of this relationship work, I'm understanding patience on the scale of years. And there's something that's really, really empowering about that. Like I get to extend that out, and it lets me soften my grip. It lets me soften that neediness without letting it go. It's sort of a both and. Like the neediness is there and it can exist, and I can work on other ways of satisfying it. And maybe it can be satisfied in a different way down the line that I don't know yet. And patience is the bridge to be able to hold it over time so that I can be with something that, in shorter bursts or in bursts of like, I need to solve this, can start to feel less bearable.
I'm glad that you spoke to that, because I think that's something that I have work to do around as well, is patience in terms of years versus weeks or months or days or hours or minutes. That understanding that some things are a process and you can't rush that process. And it's okay that there might be resources that come in. Like you said, there might be something, a year ago, you didn't have this men's group in your life, for example, and this is significantly enriching your life and you didn't know about it before. And now here it has arrived, and trusting and knowing that there will be other opportunities like that, that will come in, that can come in, is fundamentally different than this is how my life is. It's how it's always going to be. So if something isn't working now, it'll never work. Right. It's a different way of seeing it, of, okay, something isn't working the way that I want it to. I'm not sure how this is going to be different or how I'm going to grow here. And I have some patience. I have some trust and faith that something can shift, and I'm holding that position of possibility. So thank you. I can't thank you enough for being on and sharing of yourself so honestly and so forthrightly. Usually I ask guests, how can people keep in touch with you? I think what I'll say here is if you heard yourself in this story, if there's something that you want to know more about, you can always get me at dearmanpodcast@gmail.com. And I can pass that on to Lucas. If you have any questions or any comments or, celebrations or insights that you gleaned, I think that would be most welcome. So you can always get me at dearmanpodcast@gmail.com. And I just want to thank you again for being here and sharing with us.
Thank you, Mel.